Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in, and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now today, we're going to talk about marriage without remorse, being willing to change. Let me read to you a principle that is crucial in the spiritual life and in the social life. It was not spoken, first of all, regarding marriage, but has direct application to it. Paul says in Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 4, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, broad social principle with a spiritual motive, but with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Do not merely look out for your own personal interest, but also for the interest of others. As I say, Paul didn't write that with marriage in mind, but he would certainly affirm, yes, especially do that in marriage. In the scriptures, we see examples of people who made difficult circumstances better because they were willing, as situations required, to go against ingrained habits or cultural conditioning and make changes, sometimes difficult ones, that served everybody better. Had they been thinking only of themselves and their narrow personal interest, had they not been higher-minded than that, they would not have flexed with circumstances and altered their ways of doing things. For example, Abraham, the patriarch of the Jewish nation, once had a very sensitive tension in his home that had he been a lesser man and unwilling to deny selfish interest and cultural custom, domestic life would have turned into a pretty hellish firefight on all fronts. The situation, most of you will recall, was this. His wife, Sarah, had been unable to conceive. In that culture, that was no compliment, and therefore it was a great embarrassment to the wife, any wife, no matter how much her husband loved her. Hannah, you recall, had a similar situation. Sarah was very embarrassed at being unable to present Abraham with children, especially an heir. And in her desperation, according to the customs of the time, Sarah gave Abraham her handmaid, Hagar, as her surrogate childbearer. Well, humanly speaking, that was a regrettable move. As the Proverbs teach, there are few things more unbearable than a slave who becomes a king and a maiden who supplants her mistress. Once Hagar became pregnant, she got big-headed and she began to be a big problem for Sarah. In a time when womanhood was gauged largely by the fertility of a woman's womb, it comes as no surprise to read in chapter 16 of Genesis, verse 3, her mistress was despised in Hagar's sight. Well, as you might imagine, that supercilious attitude from her handmaid went down very hard with Sarah. And, high-spirited woman that Sarah was, she had no intention of taking it lying down. Even if she was in a patriarchal culture where the husband was lord and law wrapped into one, frosted to the bone by Hagar's smirks and snide asides, Sarah even blamed Abraham, feeling, she was quite wrong, but feeling that he had given Hagar somehow the impression that Hagar was now numero uno in the domestic pecking order. Things get all distorted in some of these situations. Now, men in those cultures didn't ordinarily take their cues from their women, although women have always had powerful influence on their men. However, godly Abraham valued the peace of his home, and he loved Sarah enough not to stand pat on entrenched custom. Remember what we're talking about here? Being willing to change. In fact, he turned habit on its head, and to convince Sarah that she had not been supplanted in his affections, he authorized her to take whatever corrective steps she deemed necessary to get Hagar in line. I paraphrase, "Look, your mate is in your power. Do to her, Sarah, whatever is good in your sight." Sarah's pent-up anger was over the top, and according to the text, she treated Hagar pretty harshly. So harshly that Hagar ran away. Hagar probably brought that on herself, I would guess, and a slap on the wrist was probably not going to bring her to bay. The Lord mercifully appeared to Hagar, wandering all alone in the desert, and coaxed her to return to the family and to submit to her mistress. She gave birth to Ishmael, whom the Arabs claim as their patriarch. About 14 years later, when God gave Abraham and Sarah a son of their very own, Isaac, it wasn't too long before the latent hostility of Hagar to Sarah surfaced, as one might imagine. It was all reflected in the hostility of her teenage son, Ishmael, to little Isaac. His hassling and taunting of Isaac just set Sarah's hair on fire. Besides, she feared Abraham's attachment to Ishmael was going to lead to confusion about Isaac's inheritance, which God had promised to Isaac alone. So, Sarah determined to get Hagar and Ishmael out of the family picture. She demanded Abraham send Hagar packing. Now, this was a highly irregular move in the cultures of that time, and also highly irregular for a wife to impose on her husband her will like that. Can you imagine how that demand would have ripped the heart out of Abraham? After all, whatever Sarah thought of Ishmael, Hagar's natural son, he was Abraham's true son in every sense of the word, and Abraham loved him. But Isaac was the God-appointed family heir, and Ishmael's and Hagar's resentment of Isaac and Sarah bode nothing good for domestic happiness and harmony. So something had to give. Abraham could have told Sarah, "Look, woman, I'm in charge here. This is my son you're wanting me to summarily dismiss from the premises. You're out of place. Your order is out of place. Get over it. Deal with it. Hagar and Ishmael stay. Is that clear? I don't want to hear another word about it." Now, Abraham was no wimpy husband. He was a substantial man. He was a sophisticated man of affairs, a gentleman soldier who had once defeated a formidable army of northern invaders with a small personal army and freed all the captives they had taken. So this guy was no pushover. And in those days, women did not sass, backtalk, or talk trash to their husbands. Among his great virtues, however, was this one. Abraham was a man who sought the Lord. He's described as a friend of God, and he had sensitive ears, not tin ears, for the Lord's direction. He didn't let his male ego and pride get in the way when his wife stepped out of line and in her extreme frustration presumed, as an irate mother, to telling Abraham how things needed to be. To accommodate her demand would not only mean setting aside domestic convention, his male ego, it also meant making a change that threatened to rip his heart out in the short term for the long-term good of the family. You want marriage without remorse? You've got to be prepared to change. Well, the Lord himself endorsed Sarah on this issue, and Abraham bowed to her insistence, and, with a heavy heart, sent Hagar and Ishmael away. Now, there is, of course, folks, more to the story, but this is the part of it that is germane to our message about marriage without remorse. If a marriage is to grow and flourish, a couple has to be willing to change, both parties, has to adapt, to be flexible, to accommodate their habits, behaviors, and preferences to the other in the spirit of what the Apostle Paul said there in Philippians chapter 2. Usually the issues are not so consequential as with Abraham and Sarah, but they could be. They could be. So each spouse has to learn to give, as Paul says, not to be selfish and willful, but in the spirit of Christ himself, consider the interest and the well-being of the other partner more important than his or her own. When we are willful, stubborn, intractable, always insistent on the other person adapting or conforming to our ways of doing things, we're inviting emotional estrangement. We're creating space for our partner to harbor quiet bitterness, resentment, and space for our partner to engage in passive-aggressive behaviors, at least, which will do no one in the family any good. Before he became king and was in constant flight as a wanted man by King Saul, David and his personal army were at one point on the very cusp of a guerrilla execution of a certified ungrateful fool, whom David and his band of guerrillas had protected in vain. We see that, 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 25. The man made David so angry, so ticked off, that David decided just to take him down. The man was named Nabal. His very name means fool. He had a wife, Abigail, who was as wise as Nabal was foolish. When Abigail got wind from a servant what was going down, she made fast tracks to get to David and to head him off from what he was about to do. It was not because she loved her foolish loser husband, who was a world-class jerk, the benchmark of all foolish husbands, but because she was concerned lest David do something sinful that would mess up his conscience when he ascended to the throne of Israel, because she knew this was going to happen, and would turn out to be that messed up conscience a source of estrangement between David and God. Again, in those days, keep in mind, it wasn't the regular protocol for women to lecture men on what they ought or ought not do. At the very least, it was not the regular or expected thing. But David, king to be as he was, heard her out respectfully. And not only that, he thanked her for her wisdom. And this is best of all, he altered his plan, deciding to leave as he ought to vengeance to the Lord rather than act like a vigilante. Again, in this story too, there is more. But this is the part that is the relevant core for our purposes. Men, women, listen to me. We can't be so proud, so rigid in our ways, so settled in our course, that we can't hear the voice of wisdom. We must be able to adjust to new realities. We can't be so rigid in our ways that we can't bend to the needs of others. Yes, of course, where unchanging, compelling, godly principles, morals, ethics are concerned, yeah, sure, we must maintain our course. And we must not be deflected or deterred by pragmatic considerations or squeaky wheels who are always captives of the latest fashion or attracted always to the latest and greatest, even though it's not the wisest or soundest. I'm not talking about that. There indeed are times to stay our course, firmly, unbendingly. But we also have to understand that in all social relationships, and none more so than marriage, there are lots of times, for the good of our spouses and our whole family, that we need to revise our preferred ways and our ingrained habits. They please us, but they don't please anybody else. The principle of love entails this imperative. 1 Corinthians 10:24, let no one seek his own good, but that of his neighbor. And we could easily translate that more specifically. Let no wife seek her own good, but that of her husband. Let no husband seek his own good, but that of his wife. I say again, embedded in these general social principles is an implicit admonition to be considerate of the needs of my spouse. For what applies to society in general in our relationships certainly applies to our marriages. That social posture on Monday morning includes, among other habits, a willingness to change, to be adaptable in accommodating the needs of my spouse. Marriage begs for that willingness to flex. It's a little like having your own apartment alone. You can pretty much live in it, eat whatever you like, cook whatever you want, come and go as you please. But once you take in a roommate, and we all know this, you have to adjust so that your lifestyles do not constantly clash. Except marriage is a far more intimate and consequential relationship than having a roommate. Roommates are far more disposable than husbands or wives, so it demands marriage, that is, even more give and take, flexibility, and adaptability. Our highest incentive in growing in this virtue is more than pragmatic. It is spiritual. When we receive Christ as our Savior and Lord, then it became our life project to follow Him, to emulate Him who is the arch example of putting our interests before His own. And there is no venue where following His example is more urgent or important than in our homes. Few things so trash our credibility as followers of Christ, so contradict the testimony of the transforming power of Christ in our lives, as a bellicose, unhappy, dysfunctional home life, all because a Christian spouse in that home is so knuckleheaded, so self-willed, so self-centered, so inconsiderate, so controlling and determined that everything must be his way or her way, that they alienate their mate and gradually rip up whatever roots of love and affection once existed. Folks, one of the great mistakes people make in entering into the bonds of matrimony is taking on a mate and trying to hang on to all their old ways. Let me say that again. One of the great mistakes people make in entering into the bonds of matrimony is taking on a mate and then trying to hang on to all their old ways. Won't work. By the way, those who get married later in life usually have more trouble adjusting than others, for they're more set in their ways than the average, let's say, 20-year-old. I want to talk about things to think about in the change equation. It is one thing to hold strong views and opinions. It is quite another to hold them willfully. For example, you may not enjoy visiting your husband's family, or you may tell him the unvarnished truth that your mother-in-law is the mother-in-law from you-know-where and your father-in-law is a near relative of the backside of a donkey. Your viewpoint is clear and it's firmly held, and if it were up to you alone, you would never put yourself through the misery. However, your husband, while he understands that there's bad chemistry there, he loves his parents, despite their flaws, feels some obligation to honor them as you honor your own, with occasional visits, and feels he wants the paternal grandparents who love their grandchildren to be involved in the grandchildren's lives. He feels you should endure the short-term aggravation for the rest of the family and the long-term gain of the children. Now, a person with strong opinions is capable of holding and voicing their views, but acquiescing to the views and needs of others. The willful person, by contrast, will just keep pushing to get their way, to impose it, if possible, on everyone else at almost any cost. Now hear this also with respect to change. You can perhaps midwife a change in your spouse's character, but let me tell you something. You can never change their personality. In talking about behavioral change, this distinction is lost on most discussions I've heard. Character is a matrix of moral attributes that are learned behaviors. Personality is a matrix of genetic traits fixed from birth. They get wrapped around and intertwined with each other so that a bad character trait gives a personality trait, morally neutral in itself, a bad name. For example, I am by personality, among other things, a genetically intense, serious, passionate, high-strung personality. There's nothing to apologize for in that matrix of qualities, though that mix of personality traits is not what every wife would desire or admire in her man. But those personality qualities, which along with certain others, they seem almost boilerplate for biblical prophets from Moses to Peter to Paul. So, in some vocations and callings, those personality qualities can be assets. However, in combination with bad character traits, they can be a formula for disaster. Let me share with you a little biographical background I've never told many people. I mentioned it in my church just a while back. For most of my life, I didn't know it myself. My wife told me only 10 or 15 years ago because my mom had shared it with her, but Aussie had never told me. I was born in the Depression era in a southern West Virginia coal mining camp, uglier than sin, rougher and rowdier than a Wild West town. As newlyweds, it was just hard to survive. For the first 3 years of my life, my mom, to make ends meet, had to work as a beautician, doing the hair of the coal baron's wife and the bosses and so forth. In that period, I had, my mom said, 13 different babysitters, some of who, neighbors told mom, were mean to me and abused me. Evidently, I was not a very happy little fellow. One of my uncles couldn't stand me because I cried all the time. Now, see this. Here's a child who's intense, passionate, serious, and high-strung by nature, and you infuse that native temper with a twist in his character in the form of residual anger, and you have a problem child, potentially. Temper's not a problem in itself. A little fire in the belly's a healthy thing, not a dangerous thing, but fire out of control is a threat. I would have been a man of strong feelings and convictions and not likely to shrug when things that matter are not going the way they should. But if my character gets a twist in them, that personality formation can work more ill than good. That congenital high-spiritedness, ratcheted up and wrenched out of shape by regular mistreatment, was always my mother's greatest concern. And that is the area where the Lord has done the greatest healing work in me. I don't mean that all that is finished, but I can say few people other than my immediate family have ever seen me lose my temper in my adult life. They may have seen me irritated or annoyed, but when I lose it, you don't really want to be anywhere around. Now, if Aussie had wanted to change me, she should not try to convert me into a laid-back, fun-loving, let's-be-cool, all-kick-up-our-heels fraternity type. That is not my personality. No one can change that, and no one can change yours, nor should they. But our misshaped character qualities that distort and misuse our personality may need amendment. Embrace the personality. Work on the character issues that put that personality to bad uses. Here's another piece of advice about change. Never try to clone your spouse into your own image. For one thing, two of the same kind is domestic redundancy. Complementarity is God's design. Besides, it's so boring when everybody's the same way. Some time ago in a conversation with one of my younger brothers concerning marriage, my brother Bernard mentioned that his own marriage got a lot easier when he finally learned not to try to recreate his wife Peg in his own image. For example, he's a fuss budget about order and efficiency. Drives him bananas when things are out of place. Drives him crazy when grandkids come tear up the house. He one time said, I trained those gulls out there on his dock. I trained those gulls in 3 days not to poop on my dock. Looks to me like parents could train their kids in 3 years not to mess up my house. Gee, that's funny, to me at least. Aussie and I load a dishwasher quite differently. Not the biggest issue on earth, but we're just different. Don't try to clone your spouse into your own image. Roll with the petty issues. Just resolve the seriously contentious ones. It doesn't matter too much which way one places the toilet paper in the bathroom dispenser, but it does matter whether one flushes the toilet. Now, that's the big deal. It doesn't matter too much if one takes too much of the bed, but it does matter if one wets the bed. Next, I would say, in negotiating change, give right away to the one who has the most constitutional need to have it their way. For example, an executive that I greatly admired one time told me, I have seen ways to make somebody who works too fast to slow down, but I've never seen or learned any way to make somebody who is too slow to speed up. Some things in our spouses are just so genetically rooted and constitutionally ingrained that to try to force them to adapt to our ways is going to accomplish nothing but unproductive quarrels and frictions. I mentioned my wife. She can't stand wind to have her hair out of place. Gives her a terrible headache. Mine is as unruly as the wind, more calyx in my hair than in a pasture. Her need to avoid those conditions is greater than my need to enjoy them. Next, I would say when circumstances change, habits need to change. When the kids are no longer at home, it may be necessary for the wife to work outside the home, though you may prefer a stay-at-home wife. May drive her off her rocker if she's not one of those highly domestic types who enjoys puttering around the house. Folks, marriage is like a plant. As it grows, it changes. If it doesn't, it is dead. Well, thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.